Welcome in, and thanks for joining us on another edition of the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Eric Pfeiffer here from Hoosier Ag Today, and excited to talk ag policy again here on the podcast, and happy to be again joined by Steve Howell, policy guy with the Indiana Corn Growers Association and Indiana Soybean Alliance. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Eric. Good seeing you again.
And Andy Tower is here, policy guy with Indiana Farm Bureau. Hello, Andy.
How are we doing today, Eric?
Fantastic. And, you know, we're continuing down this this road here as we get closer to Election Day. Last time on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, we had Terry Gooden, Lieutenant Governor candidate for the Democrat side. On today's show, we have the Lieutenant Governor candidate for the Republican side. Micah Beckwith is here with us. Micah, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Eric. Good to be with you.
Glad we were able to make this work from a scheduling standpoint. It was good that we were able to make it happen. And, you know, I just want to point out that, you know, I was hit on social media last time we did this. That I said they said I did Terry dirty, that I had him holding his microphone. I want to confirm that I have Micah doing the same thing. take the photo here. Dave Blower is in the room as well. This is what I call fair and balanced.
This is awesome. It's a nice microphone. I actually am impressed. It's got the little Hoosier Ag Today. What do you call this?
These are mic flags right
mic
here.
Mic flag. Yeah, media this, mic. I see that, you know. It's like Fox News or something, you know. And, you know, it's like Hoosier Ag Today. I love it.
So this is fair and balanced coverage here. you know, on social media, on our web. I have been accused of both being too liberal and too conservative, which tells me
you're probably doing something right.
I'm doing something right.
So this is
how I'm going about things. So yeah. Micah, again, thanks for joining us. Again, today we're just looking to have a good conversation about ag policy today. The Lieutenant Governor in Indiana is the Secretary of Agriculture. You're going to oversee the Department of Agriculture if elected. You're going to, pick the Department of Agriculture Director. All of these things are going to be under your purview. So we want to hear from you on some of these ag policies. So that's what we're going to go through today and take a deeper look at, a deeper dive into. And again, like we discussed on the last one, there's no clock here. We don't have to. You know, you don't have to look up and see the white cards. I'm not going to cut your mic off at any point in time either. I've got a mute button here, but I'm not going to use it on you.
Only if I start singing.
Yeah,
so then just, he saves that for me.
Yeah, I've got the mute button for Steve and for Andy. I also have a little sound pad. I've got a rim shot here. If we start telling jokes, I can do that too.
That's great.
I don't think I need to use any of them, but for the sake of people who are, you know, maybe just tuning into this race, just getting, you know, they're out in the fields right now. They're, you know, harvest is underway. Maybe they're, hopefully they're wrapping up here at this point. But maybe they're just tuning into this race. And maybe at this point they haven't heard of who Micah Beckwith is. Do us a favor. Introduce yourself to the folks that are just kind of tuning into this Lieutenant Governor and Governor race.
Yeah,
Tell us who you are.
Thank you. So, grew up in Michigan. My dad was in the dairy industry. He was the president of the Michigan Dairy Association. He had a packaging company. We packaged for dairies, dairy products around the country. And so, kind of was in the sales and marketing side of things. And my dad was in, then we got into the flavoring aspect. So, started another company that creates flavoring ingredients for dairies. And so, we'd sell the flavoring to dairies when they were running their products, their milks and their ice creams and things like that. So kind of just really, you know, I loved the dairy world from very early on. I remember going, you know, all over the state and just seeing the greatness of that state. And then I went to Huntington University. That's how I got into Indiana. So in 2000, came to Huntington. My parents, you know, trained me in, you know, what God says is right and what the Constitution says, as our founding fathers looked to the principles of the Bible to build everything on. And so those were kind of the two guiding lights that I've always kind of had in my heart. And when I came to Huntington, I loved Indiana. I met my beautiful bride there, and we got married and moved to Noblesville, where she was from. And I've been working in ministry and also small business ownership. I've owned a couple different small businesses, and I've also worked for my dad's company on the side. And, you know, I always thought I was going to go full-time into the business. We're going to move back to Michigan after I graduated from Huntington. But, you know, God often, you know, has different plans for us. You know, the Bible says we plan out our paths, but the Lord directs our steps. And I think that's... I'm living proof of that. So that's my background, and I've been in full-time ministry for 18 years now, I guess. So, yeah.
some people say that we make plans and then God laughs. That's, you know, it's kind of how it works.
I think that's how it works. Yeah, that's how it worked in my life.
Yeah, so, he chuckles a little bit. Says, nope, got this for you.
Yeah.
So let's get some questions here from the organizations that represent farmers. Again, the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, they sponsor this podcast with support from Indiana Farm Bureau as well. So we've brought them in here. Randy Crone couldn't be with us today, so Andy Tower is stepping in here and helping out. But let's get the first question here from Steve Howell, the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. You know, we've hit on economic development and biofuels. I imagine that's where we want to go first here, Steve.
Yeah, let's just go ahead and start off with the biofuels issue. We've had a bill in the past few sessions to provide incentives for retailers to offer higher blends of both ethanol and biodiesel. We see that as a great opportunity to give a little boost to agriculture here in Indiana. The quickest way to additional corn grind is through higher blends of ethanol, and we're heading into some years of with lower prices we see coming up that we need to find additional markets. So I guess the question would be, what should the state of Indiana do to support the biofuels industry, which directly impacts corn and soybean farmers?
Yeah, good question. I think, as I see it, for a long time, it's really been the EPA. We've had federal regulations that have been hindering what we can do. And so I think the state of Indiana, first and foremost, needs to fight Washington. And and if you go to bat for your farmers against these overbearing, overreaching regulations, that'll take the handcuffs off our farmers to be able to do what they want to do. And I think the craziness of what is the waiver every 20 days? If you're a convenience store selling gasoline and you want to do was the higher blend or the ethanol blend.
Yeah, the EPA has to grant a waiver for summertime sales.
That's right.
We've got to get past
that's
that.
That's crazy. To me, that is insane. It's like, why is the government stepping in and making it so hard to do business? Let the market do what the market does. So I think first and foremost, from the Braun Beckwith team, you're going to get somebody that will fight the federal regulations that keep farmers from being able to do what we know is best for our own families, our own crops, and our own businesses.
Andy, I imagine I know where this first question's coming from, just like we did with Randy on the last podcast. You know, Indiana Farm Bureau just put out some legislative priorities here somewhat recently. I imagine, let's see, property taxes, water. Which one are you going with here?
Actually, I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball.
Here we go.
Before we get down into those, I mean, as Eric alluded to and you kind of mentioned, Micah, you know, if you're elected lieutenant governor, you will be oversee the State Department of Agriculture. So would like to hear a little bit of kind of your vision for ISDA, kind of what are some priorities that you and potential Governor Braun would have for ISDA and agriculture here in Indiana?
Well, I think the big thing is just bringing the world to Indiana to see what we have. I mean, I think you open up the door to show the power and the prestige and the innovation of what Indiana has in the ag world. I mean, Purdue being in our state is an amazing blessing. And the fact that we you know, have Indiana and we still, or have Purdue in Indiana, and we still don't necessarily seem to be the cream of the crop, the city on a hill in the United States for the ag world. It seems like I'm always talking about places like Iowa or Kansas or Nebraska, or Texas, you know, when it comes, I get frustrated because I'm saying, man, Indiana really should be on those, it should be at the top. I mean, there's no reason why that couldn't be the case. And so I think working with places like Purdue, working with the schools that have ag departments, you know, my alma mater, Huntington, has an ag department now. I think that's going to be, you know, first and foremost on my heart to just, I'm a good amplifier. I'm a good salesman. I like to take a vision and run with it. And so if something is good in Indiana, like our ag, I mean, our ag is the backbone of our whole state, the economy that, I mean, we've got to sell this to the world. So opening up the world, letting Indiana become really known as the breadbasket of the United States, I think would be the goal. And I think you're going to see things from a Braun Beckwith administration that, again, is going to cut regulations. I know we're probably going to get into the property tax issue. how do you incentivize the next generation to want to jump into the family business? And right now, I would say there's a lot of de-incentives that we're seeing from because of what the federal government's done and what, you know, bad policies from the Biden-Harris team have done. We're seeing that, and so we're gonna have to cut through that. We're gonna have to fight against those waves. But I think that's probably gonna be the, you know, number one on Mike's mind and also on mine as the Secretary of Ag.
From an ISDA standpoint and the other agencies that the Lieutenant Governor oversees, how do you see all of those working together under your leadership? I mean, we're talking about the Office of Rural Development. We're talking about just a number of the Office of Tourism. How do you see all of those, under your supervision, if you're elected Lieutenant Governor, working to really build, rural economic development, rural Indiana? How do you just kind of, what is your vision for that, along with Senator Braun? What is the vision there?
So I think the vision for me, and I think Senator Braun would say the same thing, we're business owners, we're leaders within our own industry, within our own communities. From a church perspective, I've been overseeing teams for a long time, overseeing staffs for a long time. My strength is not being the expert in the room. My strength is getting the experts in the room who believe in the shared vision, the common goals, the values of Indiana, getting them together and then letting them do what they're good at doing. So I'll just use Don Lam as an example. As I've seen him just navigate this world in the Department of Ag, as a director, I've been really impressed. There's no reason for us to come in my opinion, and try to fix something that isn't broke. Say, okay, if Don's doing a good job, and I've talked to farmers all over the state, most of them have nothing but high praise to say about Don. And so I would look at that and say, okay, let's get Don at the table. Let's get the Farm Bureau experts. Let's get the Alliance experts. Make sure that everyone has a seat at the table. And then collectively, we can start finding the right solution. So again, I'm not going to be somebody that comes in and says, I know all the answers, and this is what I think needs to happen. I will say, let's get people together. And then as people start sharing their wisdom, you know, again, I'll go back to what God's word says. Forgive me for preaching, but it says that there's wisdom in a multitude of counselors, right? What does that mean? It means get a lot of people around the table who have expertise, let them speak their mind, let them openly share, and together then you will find the right solution going forward. And so that's my leadership style. I think that's Mike Braun's leadership style as well. So that's how we'll tackle the issues in the next, 4 to 8 years.
Have you had conversations, you and Mike, about who might lead that Department of Agriculture?
Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, we have. There hasn't been a, definitive, but from everything that I can see is, like I said, Don is probably the guy in the running right now. I mean, I've not heard any other names other than Don, because I think everyone, even in the Braun team, is saying, well, I mean, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. Do we have things we can shore up? Sure. I mean, I think Don's got a vision that I like for the future of Indiana Ag, and I think we got some steps we can take, but I think he's doing a good job.
Steve?
Well, I guess one thought that I have is an area that we see that there could be an improvement is having the ag industry a part of a vision for economic development in Indiana. Yeah. We see a lot of opportunities within agriculture, whether it's not just production agriculture, but the processing, industrial biotech. What can we do to attract industrial biotech to Indiana? We've got all these bioprocessing facilities across the state. How can we leverage that with Indiana as being a good place to do business? But how do we get agriculture at the table for economic development projects and planning, and how do we attract more ag development?
Great question. I've heard rumblings that maybe the ag world or the ag director will come under maybe more of a cabinet position within the governor's purview to get a seat at the table. Now there's pros and cons to that. Right now it's not, but we could see that. I think the way, just getting to know Mike as well as I've gotten to know him on the campaign trail, he's a consensus builder. You're not going to have any problem getting the robust engine of the agriculture economic driver in our state at the table. They're going to welcome you into that. I will push for that. I will make sure that you have that seat at the table when it comes to, hey, when we're looking at our economy on the whole, we've got to make sure that ag is right there. Really, to my, and this is how I see it, ag is the backbone of our state from an economic perspective, but also I see it as a really a national security issue, because you look at farmers, you look at what they know to be true about God's creation, their communities, their families, they're God and country type people. They love their families, they love their communities, they love the Lord, they want to do what's right by those metrics. And I think that is good for our state, that's good for our nation. So if we protect the family farm, if we fight for the family farm, we're actually fighting for Hoosier values that then protect every economic industry in our state. So I see it as a must, and I'm going to fight to get, you know, ag being the economic driver and the seat at the table that people always say, hey, how will this, whatever we do, what is going to be the effects on the ag world? And if it's good for the ag, let's do it. If it's not, then let's hold off.
I want to follow up on this because I think it leads to a larger conversation about how the Indiana Economic Development Corporation works with agriculture. I think that there's been maybe a bit of a contentious relationship between that and agriculture, and I don't mean, you know, they're totally, you know, butting heads all the time.
They're
but
throwing
I,
stuff at each other from across the office.
Well, yeah, I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but I mean, we can take a look at this LEAP project, and I'm sure that will lead into a question that Andy has here in a moment, just talking about water, but just from the standpoint of, you know, buying up farmland and developing on it.
Yeah.
You know, there are some real things that, man, they're just at odds right now. Yeah. I think, and I think that there are some questions about how the IEDC will continue to operate under a new administration and how it's operated under previous administrations. Can you just speak to how you foresee the IEDC working under a Braun Beckwith administration going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. We get this a lot. I'm going to be up in Tippecanoe County tonight talking to a great group of individuals. And I know that will be, you know, top of mind for them, the LEAP project, the water issue, IEDC. And Mike has been very clear on this. I have been extremely clear on this as well. IEDC has really jumped the shark. They've got over their skis. They created a black eye for that agency because of what's happened in the LEAP project. And again, it's not that we're against economic development on the whole, but when you do it under the cover of darkness and you won't let the locals have their fair say in what's going on, then you shouldn't do it. I always have red flags go up whenever I see government at the higher level trying to come in and push their will on a lower level of government or the people. So when the federal government comes into Indiana, tries to tell Indiana what to do, I always have my, you know, my guards up and I'm ready to go to battle for the state. But when the state goes into the counties and tries to do the same thing, I'm going to err on the side of the counties and for them to tell the state to go away. And this is our land. You're not going to get away with, you know, what you're doing here. So, and if it's good for the counties and the communities, well, guess what, state? Again, I told you I'm in sales. Go and sell it. If it's a good product, if it's a good reason to do what you want to do, then you should have no problem selling it to the people of the community. But if you can't sell it to the people of the community, then maybe it's not a really good idea. And so I'm always going to err on the side of the little guy. And so if the little guy doesn't like it, I'm going to fight with the little guy. I'm going to make the bigger guy have to sell the idea, and not, you know, just not going to come in and bulldoze your way into a community that doesn't want it. That's what's happening with the LEAP project.
Now, I'm gonna take this maybe a step farther here. And on the very first Indiana Ag Policy podcast that we did, it was with Kendall Culp, and we were talking about his bill from a year ago, talking about foreign ownership, and his meeting with the IEDC. And the bill about foreign ownership, and they were like, hey, can we make some adjustments here? Because we've got some projects in the pipeline here, and this might impact some of them. And and he's like, well, how many? Well, really almost all of them.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was, you know, well, okay, well, how many of them are China? Well, all of them.
So I
guess, you know, that's the where do you stand? Where does the Braun Beckwith I mean, where do you guys stand on foreign ownership of ag land, the bill that's currently in place, and where things need to go from here?
I appreciate what Kendall did with that bill. I was following it closely, and even as a business owner and a pastor, I was speaking out in favor of that bill. I think the bill can be stronger. It should be stronger. I think there's still loopholes. China can create shell corporations and come in and still buy up land. I think we got to look into that. I don't trust China. I mean, China's made it very clear they want to dominate the world. They want to be the superpower. They're a communist country. Communism is totally diametrically opposed to what we believe here in the United States. And we have to be bold and willing to say, hey, we're not going to give up our land to foreign hostile nations that don't have American values in their interest. And so I appreciate again what Kendall did. I'd like to see it stronger. And you'll get some pushback. I mean, there will be farmers that say, well, property rights. I want to be able to sell my land to whoever I want to sell it to. Listen, your property rights, I will fight for those property rights, but you don't have a right to sell out your country. You don't have a right to do something that's going to hurt the community or the state. And listen, we have ordinances and all kinds of things. I just built a coffee house at our church, put $2 million into it from our church to do ministry. And we get to the end and we want to put a sign on the building. And you know what the city said? Can't put a sign on the building. And we're like, why? Well, it's just an ordinance. And you know, it's just dumb. I don't like that, but they tell us what to do all the time, right? And so this idea that, hey, somehow property rights are limitless. No, they've never been limitless. There's always, you know, liberty. I'm a person of liberty. Liberty is different than freedom. Freedom, you're just free to do whatever you want. Liberty is freedom under control. You know, Aristotle said, the law are the wise restraints that keep men free. And I think that's what we have to remember when we're putting in policies is to protect. Yes, we will protect your property rights, but you have a duty to do what's responsible with that freedom. And if you won't be responsible, there's going to be guardrails that make sure that it is responsible.
I imagine you've got some follow-up questions here on either the LEAP project and the water stuff or maybe some of the farmland property rights.
Yeah, so I think, you know, and kind of pulling a couple threads there, Micah, I mean, you know, you mentioned farmers being the backbone of the state and farmer protection, farmland protection. Well, one of the biggest challenges that we continue to hear from our members is I'm going to go back to the property tax conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've saw 2 years of double-digit growth in property taxes, estimated another 20% jump coming in 2025. And so, you know, in the challenge for our members, you know, they are getting hit with these property tax bills. At the same time, we're seeing net farm incomes decline. And so how do we find a path forward in terms of property tax reform, all the while being able to protect our rural communities? Because back to this is where our members live, work, and play, and those property taxes go directly to fund local community
about
services.
85%, I think, of property taxes go to fund some of these rural communities and everything they do. Property taxes, I think the Farm Bureau study was 26.1% from last year to this year was the increase. That's insane. And if you're saying it's going to go up you're estimating another 20%.
Another 20% in 2025.
So you're talking basically 50% increase in 2 years.
And that's not to mention the 17% it went up the year before.
Okay, so that's not sustainable. That's not sustainable. That is not sustainable. There is no way in any business environment that the government can tax an industry that much and still think that industry is going to be left standing within 5 years. And so to me, this is why I've been hounding the property tax issue for a couple years. I started seeing this a few years ago. And I will tell you right now, on principle alone, where I stand, property taxes are unconstitutional. If you go back to the founding documents, nowhere would the founders ever allow the government to make you pay to stay on your own land, because that means it's not your own land. If you have to pay the government rent to stay there, it's not your property. It's really the government's property. They're giving you the privilege, and I'm using air quotes, to stay on that land. Founders would have been absolutely opposed to that. And so I also know that we've created this problem over about 100 years, and we can't just fix it overnight. So I'm not saying that we just pull the rug out because it would destroy rural communities. But my heart will always be to get it back to what it was more intended to be. And so with me, and I know with Mike, we are going to be fighting tooth and nail for those property taxes to come down big time, because we cannot sustain this type of egregious overreach by government. If this goes on much longer, our farmers are going to die. And then all the conglomerates, the big corporate farms are going to come in. They're going to buy up all the small family farms. We won't have small family farm anymore. I love small family farms. That's where my heart is. I mean, that's who I worked with in Dad's company. And again, it's the people. I love the people there. So I'm fighting for the small family farmers. And if we can get those property taxes big time down, I mean, I'm saying, like, it better. And we got to figure out what to do with the local communities. Yes, we will. We're not just going to, you know, people say, well, you won't be able to fund fire and police. And it's like, yeah, we will. We did it 100 years before. When we didn't have property taxes, we can do it again. It's just going to take getting a lot of people in the room to be able to say, what's the path forward? But Mike's going to lead that. I'm right there with him. I got his back on that, because farmers cannot sustain this.
Go ahead. Do you have a follow-up, Andy?
Yeah,
go right ahead.
I think I just want to, because you made the point. I mean, you know, we've got to have police and fire, because, you know, those are key services to our members. I mean, when you make that phone call,
right,
especially as we've unfortunately saw this harvest, we've saw a lot of fires
just
out there.
Driving down 65 yesterday, another big fire right there on the interstate. I mean, yeah. My goodness.
Wow. Yeah, it's crazy. And so having that, the other one that's closely tied to it, and again, is a real passion for a lot of our members, is those rural and local schools.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as soon as we lose that basketball gymnasium, as iconic as they are for Indiana and important, I mean, you lose the small town. And so I think that's the question and the challenge that our members have put in front of us, is how do we find that balance? And so really excited to work with you all.
Thank you. I think, too, going to the school issue, and it's a little bit off topic here, but, you know, we talk about property taxes. Just so you guys know, our state budget over 2 years is $44 billion, right? So whenever they pass a budget, it's a $44 billion budget. $22 billion goes to education, and that is not including property taxes. And then you get another $7 billion from property taxes that goes to education. So we're spending about $30 billion of a $44 billion budget on education. And the return on investment, again, I'm a business guy, Mike's the same way, we're looking at it, and we're saying the return on investment is not, we're not getting a good return for what we're spending. I mean, that's insane that we're spending that much money, and education is floundering. And in some rural communities, it's better. So I'm not, you know, if you're listening to this in a rural community, I know places like, I was up in Napanee, their schools are great because they still have good foundations of family values that are undergirding that whole system, and teachers can teach. But when you get into some of the suburbs and you get into this woke nonsense that's been going on in some of our inner city schools, it's destroying public education, and they just say they want more money to fix it. It's not a money issue. And so when I see our farmers getting just bludgeoned to death because of property taxes, and then I see the return on investment is terrible for education, it's really a hard sell for me when they say, hey, we got to protect property taxes because of our schools. It's like, well, I'm pretty sure our schools don't need the AstroTurf field in order to teach good math and science. But yet somehow they say, oh, we're going to up your property taxes. And then they build a weight room like they did in Brownsburg that is world class. Not even pro players in the NFL have a weight room that looks that good, right? And so all that to say, we've got a major on the majors and minor on the minors. And what we've done in education, and it's hurting our farmers, is we're majoring on the minors and minoring on the majors. So I think Mike, being that business guy that he is going to get it back into right order.
As far as property taxes are concerned, you know, going back and listening to our last podcast, bringing to this one, you know, I asked Terry Gooden, going back to the debate and some of the conversation there. The Democrats didn't have a property tax plan at the lieutenant governor debate. He called the Republican plan a knee-jerk reaction. And he called it a knee-jerk reaction on this podcast. And I said, well, Terry, you guys didn't have one. And then a couple days after the debate, you did. Some might call that a knee-jerk reaction. He had an answer. He said, we did the research. We did that.
In 2 days?
He still believes that the Republican plan was a knee-jerk reaction. You guys did come out with several versions of it, you know, finding some faults here and there and making some adjustments along the way.
Yeah.
His comment on the last podcast was that for farmers, the plan that you have is going to increase property taxes at this point. What would be your response to that comment?
It's not going to, and we're going to make sure that not only does it not increase, it's going to decrease for farmers too. Again, farmers are on the purview. We've got great people in place. We've got guys like J.D. Prescott, Scott Alexander, guys that really know farming well that we're working with. We've got guys like Travis Holdman who come from farming communities. They're not going to do something that's going to negatively impact our farmers. Again, what's happened to farmers with property taxes is an egregious overstep of government. We aren't going to let that happen. Mike's not going to let it happen. I'm not going to let it happen. And to say it's a knee-jerk reaction, I've been shouting this from the rooftops for the last 3 years. Along with my good friend Rob Kendall on WIBC. And you know, if you know Rob, I mean, property taxes is the thing. And I think my election at the convention was because I've been out there fighting for farmers, fighting for the little guy, and saying the government has far overstepped. And so with me in that lieutenant governor's office, you're not going to have somebody that's just going to get pushed over when someone comes in and says, oh, well, we want more money from you, so give us more of your property taxes. You're going to have somebody like me that's been fighting for years to say no. I'll be doing that in the lieutenant governor's office. It wasn't knee-jerk. This was 3 years of me saying, let's get this under control. This was my research. This was working with guys like Rob. This was working with guys like JD. This was working with people all over the state to say, what can we do to fix this? And so what you saw, sure, was we did tweak it a little bit, but to me, what Mike Braun did in that moment, when he said, here's our plan, he gave the legislature the freedom now to address this issue. The executive branch can't address the issue. This is a legislative fix. It has to be a legislative fix, because if the executive branch doesn't like an executive order, it's only fixed for 4 years. If it, you know, going to the next governor or 8 years, you know, and when we get another governor, they can just override the executive order and then it doesn't actually fix it. So what Mike did by putting out his plan was he gave the legislators cover now to bring their ideas to the table. So you got Mike Young, you got J.D. Prescott, you got Travis Holman, you got Jeff Thompson, you got the speaker and the president pro tem. They're all now talking about what is happening, what can we do to fix it. And you're going to see some people say, oh, that's too far. And then you're going to see people that say, that's not far enough. But that's what the leadership that he has brought and he will continue to bring, and I'll do the same thing.
Let's take a time out here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. We still have a lot to get to here on the podcast, brought to you by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, with support from Indiana Farm Bureau.
There is strength in numbers. That's why the Indiana Soybean Alliance membership and policy and Indiana Corn Growers Association need you. These organizations represent Indiana soybean and corn farmers on critical and regulatory issues affecting their industry. Along with support from the national organizations, National Corn Growers Association and American Soybean Association, the Indiana members help determine public policy positions on critical issues, including farm bills, trade policy, and ethanol and biodiesel legislation. Become a member of Indiana Soybean Alliance membership, Indiana Corn Growers Association, or both. Visit incornandsoy.org to select a membership. That's incornandsoy.org.
At Indiana Farm Bureau, we serve tree farmers, goat farmers, and in fact, all farmers. With over 250,000 members, Indiana Farm Bureau represents a broad range of farmers and puts power in your collective voice. You also get advice from our subject matter experts, more affordable health plan options, and support for youth programs statewide. So whether you grow soybeans or strawberries, membership means you'll be heard. Become a member today at infb.org.
We're back here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, and we've only touched the surface here. We've got a lot more to get to here. Eric Pfeiffer here from Hoosier Ag today, Steve Howell with Indiana Corn and Soy, Andy Tower with Indiana Farm Bureau, and Micah Beckwith, the Republican candidate for Lieutenant Governor, is with us here on the podcast today. And we are not too far away from Election Day, November 5th. Get out and vote, because from what I hear, if you don't, you don't get to complain. That's just how it works.
That's right.
Steve, let's talk a little bit more here about corn and soy and some of the priorities that are out there here for you folks.
Well, and I'll welcome Andy's input on this one as well, but the whole issue of water, the state doesn't really hasn't really focused on water quantity issues. I think we've done a great job through IDEM addressing water quality issues. I believe that farmers have done a tremendous job of implementing practices that lead to better water quality. But with the LEAP project we talked about, that's kind of put a spotlight on water availability issues. And I guess what's your vision there? How do we I'll just start off with, we need more information. We don't have a good understanding of the of what water is available and where, how much is available, how particularly with groundwater, how quickly does it regenerate those aquifers. We just need more information there, more test wells to see what's going on with those aquifers so we know what's available. So any thoughts on that?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it's, we don't know what we don't know. And so again, just my leadership style, I know Mike's the same way, is getting the experts in the room to say, okay, give us the information. As I've done my research and dug into this on the water issue specifically, what I'm finding is we have the water. It's really just moving the water to where it needs to be is the issue. But that takes a lot of money, takes a lot of time, takes a lot of planning, and then you're going through somebody's property, right? I mean, that's the hard part. And I am not an eminent domain supporter, rarely, right? I think there's a time and a place, but it has to be a very rare time and a place. And I think that's when you start saying, okay, well, we don't want to trample on property rights, but we got to move water 100 miles from one aquifer to a community. Then how do you do that in a way that honors the property owners that you're gonna need on board? And how do you do that in a way that doesn't, like we see with the LEAP project, doesn't potentially drain a whole community of its water resources? So I'm not saying I have the perfect answer or the solution yet, but I do know the solution starts when you get everybody in a room. And I think the leadership that I have seen, and I don't want to bash the current leadership of the state. So please hear me. I'm not trying to do that, but I do think it's important to hold those in power accountable to what they've done or haven't done. And I think the biggest criticism that I've heard of the Holcomb administration, and the Braun administration will be vastly different than this, is that they just aren't accessible to the people that need to bend the ear of the governor. I was talking to a legislator the other day, someone who'd been in an office now for almost 2 years. This is their first term, and they said they've never met the governor. They've never met the governor. This is one of 150 representatives, lawmakers, House and Senate. How do you not have the governor's ear? How have you never met the governor? I'll tell you this about Mike Braun. You can say what you will about, you know, things he's done or hasn't done, whatever. The criticisms are all out there for a lot of different sides, but you cannot say he's not accessible. I mean, for 6 years as senator, he's opened up his office down in Jasper and welcome anyone in to bend his ear. What he's going to do with the legislature is to open up the governor's residence as a ground zero meeting space to talk about the issues of the day with the legislators and with people who know these issues. So I think that's why I think we will be able to address the water issue. It is going to be getting people in the room. They're going to have Mike Braun's ear. I will be a sounding board as well for people when they need to, you know, if they're saying, well, it's hard to get to so-and-so, well, come to me, Secretary of Ag, tell me, and then I will go walk across the hallway and, you know, kick in any door I have to without, you know, getting thrown in jail, obviously, because that would probably be, you know, vandalism, kicking in doors. But you know, the proverbial, like, hey, I'm going to go into that office and say, hey, this is what I'm hearing, what's going on about that? So I think that's how we'll approach those issues. I don't think we have a water resource issue. I think we have a water moving issue. That's just what I've seen. And I could be wrong, but I'd also want to make sure we protect local communities and property rights. So
is this water moving issue, from what you've seen, it's going to cost quite a bit of money to move that water. And that's what we're running into right now.
Well, I think, yeah, it's going to cost a lot of money to move that water, I think. But the one thing we've got to be cautious about as we get to the southern third of our state today, we're already moving a lot of water around through rural water cooperatives and those type of things. Because to your point earlier, I mean, I think what we all are starting to understand, we do have a lot of water here in Indiana. We're blessed, but it may not always be in those right locations. So if we do need to start moving, because you think about, you know, I hear President Crone talk all the time during that I-69 corridor going south, there's not a whole lot of places to stop because there's not water along that corridor. And so if we're serious,
you run out of gas there, man. You're walking for a long
exactly.
time.
Exactly. You got a Country Mark opportunity, and then a Hux, I believe, down in Washington. But otherwise, that's right. You're in trouble.
Yeah. Yep.
But so as we think, I mean, it all kind of ties back to rural economic development. I mean, because without water, we're not going to have in some areas farms because we can't water our livestock or raise our crops. And so how do we find that balance and tying in those local community leaders? But I think one of the things that we continue to hear from our members is they have made investments in irrigation wells as an insurance protection. I mean, when we have years like this, we can turn on the center pivots, we can get water onto our crops. We've got a great specialty crop industry kind of in the Southwest and then some in the North, again, dependent on that water, as well as our livestock folks. How do we find protections for those investments that agriculture has made? Because we've got some protections on the books for small residential wells, but currently ag is pretty far down on the list in terms of that. And again, back to your comment, the backbone. What's your kind of perspective on finding opportunities to protect ag in the waters conversation?
Well, I think when I talked to President Crone about this a few months ago, that was the big thing is, hey, these are multi-million dollar investment properties. And when places like Tippecanoe County now can't water their crops, you've just threatened this multi-million dollar investment of a farmer. And so to your point, I agree with what you're saying. Again, I don't think it's a water resource issue. I think it's a water movement issue. Where do we get it from? How do we get it there? And Eric, like you said, it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. And I don't have the solution right away. I mean, that's, again, I'm not the...
I'm sorry. We're going to need answers here, Mike. That's why we brought you in today was for answers. I don't know. Someone should have told you that.
I'll
help you out.
Yeah,
I think what we need is a water strategy. And it's going to take several sessions of the General Assembly to address each of these steps.
Yeah.
And again, the first step, you know, what do we have available? And then how do we protect the water users that are currently
I think Steve just signed up to be your water czar.
I love it.
Is that what you wanted your title to be?
Czar.
Yeah, you and Kamala, you guys can have the czar titles next to each other. There we go. Oh. So. I'm sorry, I just offended everyone in this room. I think you're right.
I've been
though.
Called worse.
No, me too. Join the club. I think you're right though. I think it is. It's going to be a comprehensive strategy. It's going to be a lot of voices. I mean, it's going to be guys in the legislature that know and understand this issue. It's going to be Farm Bureau. It's going to be working, you know, with the Indiana Soybean Alliance. I mean, you're going to see all of these people coming in and making sure that, like, everybody's in the room. And so I think that's really where you start. I'll just put another plug in for Mike. He will be the guy to lead that charge. I guarantee it, because he wants everybody in his ear. He does want everyone to have a voice, and then he'll take what he thinks is the best strategy, and that's where the strategy will come from right there. So
Andy, any other questions? You've got Randy's list here.
Yeah, I've got Randy's notes.
You've got Randy's notes.
It's like a binder.
He came prepared.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, in this water conversation, I think what you're saying, Mike, is spot on. I think one of the things that we're interested in is, you know, as we look longer term on a water strategy, water plan, is there opportunities for a regionalized approach? I mean, as we work with, because we at Farm Bureau, we feel pretty strong that those rural communities, I mean, local control, we have to have them in the conversation. And so in your vision, and as you've talked to Senator Braun, I mean, do counties, do regions throughout the state have a place in really helping lead and foster this discussion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and I'm always a little reluctant of any regional, you know, talk, because that typically means there's going to be a big guy that comes in and takes over for the little guy, or tries to push the little guy into a corner. And so I'm always a little bit hesitant, but I do think that it's a statewide problem. And so it needs to be state, regional, and local, all all in the same room. And I go back to what I said earlier, the best way to accomplish this is to sell it. What are the incentives for the communities? Because I'm a local control guy. I think home rule works best and all the way up the chain. So I don't want the county telling the city what to do. I don't want the state telling the county what to do. And I don't want the federal government telling the state what to do, right? So I think that's kind of my background. But when we have big problems that encompass an entire area like a state, then it needs everybody in the room. But the state and the region has to sell it to the local communities. Why will this be good for you? And if it's good for them, they'll do it. I don't think it'll be a hard sell. And then, but normally what you see with some of these projects is that's hard. Doing the sales work is hard. It's not easy. And nobody wants to do the hard work in government. They'd rather just, you know, do whatever's the path of least resistance. That's not me. That's not Mike. We will help lead the charge, and we'll make sure that if we're going to do something in a region, that the local communities are on board with it before we do it, or else we got to go back to the drawing board and sell it better, create a better plan. It may not be the right plan for the locals, and so I think that's where we'll always be looking out for the little guy.
Steve, questions that you've got for Micah Beckwith, Lieutenant Governor candidate on the Republican ticket?
I guess just from your perspective, within the ag industry, where do you see opportunities for economic development? It's not going to be corn, soybean production, mm-hmm. but kind of up and down the supply chain, whether it's our inputs or additional processing. I mentioned the industrial biotech opportunity.
Yeah.
We see an opportunity with container shipments.
Yep.
There's a lot of containers coming full into Indiana, and they're leaving empty.
We're exporting a lot of air.
Yeah,
a lot of air.
Yeah.
Can we start charging for it?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know what? We are drinking bottled water, and 30 years ago, everyone would have said, that's crazy, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe you're onto something, Eric.
But,
so,
I mean, do you see kind of a... What's the low-hanging fruit
I think for
economic development within the ag industry, yeah, kind of up and down the supply chain?
I've thought about that after talking to farmers and different and just people in the industry. I think bioaviation fuel, I think is a good one to go after. I think that's got huge implications for Indiana if we can start. Again, that'll be the state fighting the feds, right? Because a lot of that is federal regulations making sure. But I think that would be something that I would encourage us to really start. You know, if we're trying to expand our horizon, let's look at that. I think this is gonna be a little bit more of the energy side of things, but when you have Purdue's got the individual nuclear module, you know, units that they're working on right now, I think that has huge benefits to local communities and local farms. If we can get something like that, it's a little bit more energy related and not farm related, but I think that will impact farming in a really good way if we can see that come to the market in the next, you know, decade. I think that's another area that I'd love to see. And then I've been a youth pastor for many years. I think our future, the best asset we have is our children. So what are we doing?
We just lost power in the building.
Okay.
I don't know what happened.
Fire up those nukes.
But you know what?
Did you pay the utility bill?
Yeah. You know, the soybean prices are down. Maybe we did.
The good news is we are battery powered.
Get out of town.
So we are okay. If you see me start like cranking something here, we're good to go.
There we go. Lights are back on. Here we go.
Let there be light.
Okay. Wow.
Well, yeah, no, it's back
lights,
up.
Lights are gone
but,
now.
But yeah. Again, I'm battery powered. I am power proof. You don't have to worry about me.
I think the Lord's trying to tell us something, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Eric can keep talking.
Yeah, that's right. So, where was I? Oh, our children being our greatest asset. So what are we doing to really open the door of just kind of opportunity for children to jump into this industry? I think kids, next generation, they love technology. They love the amazing things that technology can do. You go to Bex. I mean, Bex is really a computer science, facility now. I mean, the things they're doing on the science and technology end is fascinating. And I think you show that to the next generation, they're like, man, this is fun. I get to use the cool, like shiny objects, the toys of technology, but then use it to better our ag industry. And that's anything from, growing to harvesting to selling to marketing to, I mean, it really, ag really encompasses every industry. I mean, it's really not an industry that you couldn't, go into a study that you wouldn't be able to use in the ag world. And so I think that's where I would say, what are we doing for the students? I mean, how many colleges in Indiana do we have total, but how many colleges actually have a Department of Ag? I mean, you got Purdue. What do you got? Huntington, Vincennes. Who else? Am I missing some?
Somebody else just added a program. I can't.
But see, to me, that's like a little concerning. It's like, how do we only have three colleges that are creating a space for students to, you know, take part in the backbone industry of our state? Like, that would be something that I would really say, hey, let's incentivize universities to jump in the game here. And because I think the more people that do it, creates competition, and it just raises all the ships. Yeah.
I will say Ivy Tech is making some good things. They're doing some good things in that space. Andy, any other questions here for Micah?
Yeah, so I think kind of pulling on that same thread a little bit. I mean, one of the areas that our members have really advocated pretty strongly for since 2020 is rural broadband.
Yeah,
and as we talk about technology, rural economic development, I mean, I think this administration has done a great job expanding that. But how do we take that, you know, I think I remember the current lieutenant governor talking about broadband to the last mile. But one of the things as our members start to adopt new technology, what we're starting to learn is we need broadband to the last acre. And so how do you see a Braun Beckwith team starting to help push that critical infrastructure piece further out into our rural communities?
Yeah, I think we're already looking at that using grant money from OCRA. We're going to continue that program. I think, I kind of criticized the current administration a little bit earlier, but I will say give honor to where honor's due. And I think they've done a good job of pushing broadband into rural communities. And so I think they still, you know, they were on the right path. They haven't accomplished all they want to accomplish. We want to pick up where they left off, continue to push it in. They rural communities have to be connected to the world, the worldwide marketplace. It's just the world we live in. I will, the last few weeks, I have had a little bit of a check, though. Are we already behind the game with rural broadband? I look what happened out in North Carolina with the hurricanes, right? They, you know, all their communications, all their, you know, their broadband, everything went down. And so what happened? Elon Musk came in with Starlink. And so to me, I'm thinking, okay, are we not looking far enough ahead? Because I think if you're being honest, Starlink technology is probably the technology of the future. So yes, can we get broadband? But I think by the time we get broadband to every nook and cranny of Indiana, that technology is going to be very outdated. So maybe it's a both and. Why don't we look at working with Elon and the Starlink technology? How could that impact our communities? Because if we can jump ahead and just land on that, if it works, then boy, it saves us the headache and the time and the money and the infrastructure to put broadband in if we're going to be 10 years from now saying, well, broadband's already outdated. So again, that was just kind of my, you know, last couple of weeks, I've already started thinking, oh, maybe we're behind on this and we're not as ahead as of the curve as we thought we were. So
A piece of information for you, the technology that we use, the precision that we have to apply our inputs through our corn and soybean farmers, if they don't have access to the adequate broadband, it's costing about $32 an acre is what they're missing out on.
Okay.
So that's a big impact, right down to production level, not to mention the rest of rural communities.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's an amazing. That's astonishing. Yeah.
Well, and I think too. I mean, as the technology in the equipment continues to evolve, I mean, our farmer members can make real time sustainability decisions as they're moving through the field, as well as on the other end of it. I mean, that starts to change the economics. And so as we continue to roll through these tighter economic times, every little opportunity counts, and I think it adds up more and more.
Oh, without a doubt, especially when the government's taking over 50% of their taxes and property. We're not going to jump back into that. I just wanted to put the jab in there.
I would also add, you know, going back to the hurricane, the technology that was used and was still working was AM radio. So,
all right.
There is still some old technology
that is
quite useful. So
I've got a couple emergency radios in my house, and my kids are like, "What are these?"
I'm just saying, you know, some stuff still
and
works.
Then we pull out the A-tracks and we stick them in, and you know, so
yeah, we can party.
CDs.
Steve, any other questions here for Micah? As we start to wrap up here, we've covered a lot of ground here.
A lot of ground.
Andy, anything else?
So I think, Micah, just last thing for me is just, you know, big picture. I mean, you've kind of touched on a few different things, but what is, if you had to put your finger on it, as you've traveled across the state of Indiana and listened to farmers and folks in rural community, what is that number one thing that from your vantage point, if you win the election here on November 5, what is going to be the first thing in terms of ag rural communities that you want to champion?
Well, I think property taxes. I know we said it earlier. I think that'll be – I think that's the lowest hanging fruit right there. You get that under control and you free up just a wealth of resources for farmers. So that will be my priority, being a champion of getting that under control. I think then the other thing is just helping the small family farm create a business model that is incentivizing the next generation, passing on. We talked about this in your guys' office right before we got in here, is incentivizing the next generation to take over. Because, you know, this is a generation issue that we're dealing with right now. If we just look 10 years out, we're not thinking far enough ahead. Like, what's going to happen to this farm in 30 years from down the road? A lot of the businesses and the dairies that I remember working with in my dad's company, a lot of them are not there anymore. They've either sold to bigger, national conglomerates or even foreign companies, and that's concerning to me, you know, because those were good people, they had families, and they were blessings to the community. So I think those will be kind of the two things: is hitting the tax issue hard, and then making sure that we are putting really good incentives in place, or helping farmers put really good incentives in place, so that their kids want to take over.
Which could be a problem with some federal tax things for the next generation. Yes. But that's a different podcast for another day, yeah. I think. But
very much related to, you know, how do we get the next generation on the farm? How do we get the next generation of workers up and down the supply chain within the ag industry? Every sector is struggling with workforce issues. They need more employees. They need better trained employees. Agriculture is no different. What can you do? What can the state of Indiana do to incentivize folks to get trained up and to choose agriculture? The ag sector, again, maybe processing, maybe trucking, maybe repair work. What can we do to incentivize more good employees to get into agriculture?
I think the best thing government can do, because I'm not somebody that thinks government handouts or government can create jobs or anything. I don't believe that. I think the best thing government can do is make it easier for people to onboard into the industry. So we can incentivize universities to start ag programs, or to incentivize students to go to a place like Purdue. I mean, that's always going to be where I'm going to start looking. I think when it comes to the workforce issue, I mean, that's across the board. I mean, we're seeing that in every industry, not just ag. And I think you have to look at, I think you will be able to better incentivize employees to come work for you if you have more money to pay them as a business owner. I mean, it's not rocket science, it's common sense. And so how do you, you know, again, I go back to property taxes. I don't want to harp on that all day, but when you're paying more money to the government just to stay on your land, that means you cannot pay more to a good employee. So you have to cut the salary of your employees, which means you're not going to get a better employer. You're going to get somebody that's probably less equipped to do the job. So I think it's just a ripple effect. And again, it's deregulate and cut taxes. I mean, Trump showed us in 2017. Yeah, I mean, I think it was classic when Barack Obama during the 16 campaign looked at Trump and said, how are you going to do all this economic wizardry? Are you going to, like, do you have a magic wand? Or are you going to, what are you going to do, right? And what did Trump do? He just cut taxes and cut regulations. And it was a burst of energy into our economy like we've never seen in this past generation. And so I think that's the strategy. And so to answer your question, Steve, I think that's what you do. Cut regulations, cut taxes, and incentivize people using market mechanisms. And I think you'll see it successful.
I'm done for real now.
Okay, you're done now? Okay. All right. Well, you thought you were off the hook.
Yeah, that was fast, guys. Yeah. I mean,
you're not entirely off the hook yet.
Just so you know, I'm a pastor, politician. That means I normally talk on average about 5 hours at a time.
Okay.
So,
well, you know, I'm a radio host.
Yeah, so,
you know,
so we're gonna be here all day.
Oh, so there goes the power again. Okay. I do have, you know, maybe a couple of things to finish up with here.
Please.
I wanted to address this. Again, we're just a couple of weeks away here from the election. November 5th is rapidly approaching. Yeah. And I think it's safe to say, Micah, that here ever since the convention, when you got elevated into this lieutenant governor candidate role, I think that the word best used might be polarizing. You've been polarizing for the Republican Party. I think you've been polarizing for the state. Would you agree? Is it a wrong word?
No, I think you're right. I think it's fine.
I think it's safe to say. There have been a number of news stories out there, just kind of talking about how polarizing you are. Mm-hmm. You know, some things out there recently about, you know, some things you might do when you do get into office. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to just talk about those and address some of them and talk directly to the farmers and those in agribusiness that listen to this podcast and just talk about, you know, what type of leader you would be that enters the lieutenant governor's office and what types of things you see yourself doing in that role as, again, the person who would be, you know, overseeing the Senate, the person that would be overseeing these offices, the Indiana State Department of Agriculture, OCRA, you know, all of these mm-hmm. different departments, the Office of Tourism, what kind of leader you would be, other than just
polarizing.
Yeah. So I would like to give you that opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. I really appreciate that question. You know, I'm labeled as polarizing. I don't think I am. That's not who I am. Anyone who knows me knows that I'll give you the shirt off my back. I build consensus. I don't care where you are in the ideological spectrum. If we can work together, we're going to find a way to do that. Now, the media will label me this because I don't put up with some of the nonsense of today's culture. I think that's probably what I would say. So when you have the left pushing boys using girls' bathrooms, that's dumb, that's stupid, and it's dangerous. And I'm going to call it out for what it is. Anyone who wants to say that's polarizing, well, go for it. I'm not backing down on that. It's dangerous. It's absolutely, like, it's just stupid. And I have not changed my viewpoints for 25 years. What I believed in college when I went to Huntington University is exactly what I believe now. Ask anybody I went to college with. I've not changed. Now, back then, I was not polarizing. I was just sort of normal, middle of the road. So what's happened between then and now? And I'll say the culture has gone so far extreme. I mean, if I would have told you, Eric, and Steve and Andy, that 15 years ago, if we were doing this podcast 15 years ago, I'd say, hey, in 15 years, we're actually going to see the Democrat Party advocating that boys can be girls and girls can be boys and boys can play in girls' sports and boys can use girls' bathrooms. You would have said 15 years ago, I know you would have, and you all know you would have, that that's crazy, that's nonsensical, no way will we ever go that far. And yet, here we are. So if you want to say I'm polarizing, okay, I'm just going to say, no, you're off the cliff of nonsense, and I'm calling you back on because I love you enough to tell you the truth. That's the thing. Like, truth without love is mean. But love without truth is meaningless. And so I think that is where I see it as, like, listen, I'm gonna love you, and I'm gonna speak to you with grace. And again, I would sit down with anybody and help anyone. I don't care who you are, where you come from, what walk of life you are. I believe you're fearfully and wonderfully made in the image of an amazing God. So I love that. But when you start trying to push these really destructive Marxist, leftist, nonsensical ideas that we see now, I'm going to stand up and say, no, for the good of our community, the good of our children and children's children, this is not okay. People will say I'm a book banner because I got on the Hamilton County Public Library Board and had the audacity to say pornographic material should not fall into the hands of minors. And if I showed you guys, I have pictures of these books from some of these excerpts that were for children as young as 8 years old, if I showed you some of these, I know you guys, would, there's no way you'd be like, oh, that's appropriate for a, for an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old. But yet I was being called a book banner because I said, hey, I think that should go into the adult section. Let mom and dad steward that one. And I don't think an 8-year-old should stumble on that on their own. And yet somehow polarizing. Oh, you're a book banner. I said, and I just say to the left, well, you just want to put pornographic material in the hands of kids. I'm not the crazy one here. And that, to me, I will always, as lieutenant governor, say, hey, you're welcome here. You, I want to work with you. But if you want to push lies that are destructive, then yeah, you're going to have a problem with me. And I'm going to stand up for what's true and what's right and what's virtuous and good, because that is how we protect the future of Indiana. And I think it's resonating with people around the state. And most of the time, the people who say I'm polarizing, it's a very loud, small minority. When I travel the state, people come up to me and be like, hey, thank you for tweeting what you did, right? Thank you for saying that. That was just nonsense that we've been having to put up with. And finally, somebody in politics has the backbone to call it out for what it is. That's really, generally speaking, that's what I get more than the other, you know, screaming at you saying, you're crazy, you're an extremist, or whatever they want to label me, so...
One of the other things that has come up has been your, I guess, the lack of the politician side of this. This is kind of your first run at politics.
Yeah.
Do you foresee that being an issue? I mean, you're kind of being elevated to this lieutenant governor role. You don't have any of the experience of being an Indiana legislator, you know, House, Senate, yeah. but you're going to be leading the Senate. You're going to have to work with these legislators. Is that going to be an issue from your standpoint?
So I've been the director of the Hoosier Leadership Series for the last 5 years now, and we teach all about Indiana politics to Hoosiers all over the state. 7-month program. It's under the Indiana Family Institute umbrella. And so we go through, what does the legislature do? What are the different committees? How do you testify in a committee? How does the committee work? How does the floor work? How does first, second, third reading? All of these things. So I have been the director of that. So I've been teaching Indiana government to conservative-minded Hoosiers for the last 5 years. And that program has been around since the early 2000s. So Elise Nushala used to be the director of it. She's our current comptroller. Senator John Crane was the previous director before me. So just because I haven't been a politician doesn't mean I don't know how politics works. And I've followed politics. Like I said, I grew up and it was the Word of God and it was the Constitution, understanding the stewardship responsibility of every American's duty to make sure that we carry on this great American exceptionalism idea for our next gen, for our children and children's children. And so I feel very, very equipped and ready to jump in. And, you know, to the people who say, well, you haven't been a politician, listen, politics is not rocket science. Our founding fathers set this up in a way that average citizens can steward government. It's really what it was designed to be. If you go back even to the first House of Representatives in Washington, it's a 2-year term. And you'll hear some congressmen that'll be like, oh my gosh, I'm campaigning every, you know, year and a half and I have to rerun every 2 years. We need to make it longer than that. I said, no, the idea was it was supposed to be you would go to Washington, serve for 2 years. And then you come back into your farms, into your communities, you pass the torch to somebody else and they go, right? Just an average guy going in to serve, to represent your community, to say, hey, this would be good for my community, this wouldn't be good for my community. So somehow it's gone from that to now, hey, you've got to have some sort of pedigree to be a politician. That's the problem. And I would say, just look at the case study that we have. The case study is this: have we gotten better in politics or worse over the last 50 years? Do you think politicians are smarter, are more efficient, more somehow capable than they were 50 years ago? And I think if you're being honest, you're going to say, no, it seems like we're going the wrong direction. So I would say, why don't you try not always elevating the people who say, well, I have the credentials of, I've been in office for 30 years. And to me, that's not a credential. That's, you need to get a real job.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I appreciate you coming on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast today. Andy, Steve, thank you guys for joining us here as well.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Glad we were able to make this work.
Yeah.
And again, November 5th, it's like here. But
13 days. Now, who's counting? But I will say this: it still feels like it's a million miles away. And I think, you know, the night before the election, I'll probably be like, oh. It's like it's tomorrow, you know. But right now, we got our head down. We're getting to every place we can possibly get. I mean, my schedule has been jam packed, or else I would have come in earlier. I mean, thank you for working with my schedule. But To anyone listening, you know, I think what you're going to get with the Braunbeck with administration is common sense, bold leadership. You're going to get a vision that works for everybody, even if we don't agree on ideological spectrums. Like, I'm going in to defend your liberties too, and so it'll be an amazing 4 to 8 years, Lord willing. And I think Indiana will start to be talked about as some of those states that are really leading the charge when it comes to stewarding the American dream. So.
Well, is there a big party planned? I mean, is there?
I think so.
Okay.
I think we're going to be down in the JW, I believe. So if you're listening to this, you want to come on down. I believe it's open to the public. I don't know. Just show up and say Mike has said to come on in. So I'm sure that'll be fine.
I was waiting for my invite yeah, on like a gold plated thing.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to flash my press pass anyway.
There you go.
I mean, not that I really have one, but I can create one, right? I mean, that's. Yeah. Press people get to do that, right?
Yeah, sure.
Create what you want and walk in wherever you want.
I've found in life, if you act like you know what you're doing, then you'll probably be able to go anywhere. So
perfect.
It's worked for me.
Perfect. It's worked. All you've ever been able to do is act like you know what you're doing.
Make it till you make it, right? Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. It's been brought to you by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, Indiana Soybean Alliance, with support from Indiana Farm Bureau.